Okay, thank you everybody for being here. What I thought we would do is talk about the last year and where we're going next this coming year. We had some challenges when we started with the restructuring and consolidation. That was a tough time. We came out of that strong and had some impressive performance metrics. We had to do some work to ensure that people have all the resources they need to do their job well. And so today we're going to go over the performance metrics of really the last 12 months. I've been here now 12 months as of this week. And so I want to talk about where we've come and where we're going. By the way, this is the new seal that Barclay Butler, Dr. Butler, where are you, Dr. Butler? Good job with this seal. This is impressive. This is the first time we've had a seal for the FDA, and it's very impressive. So I'm looking forward to wearing this pin. We've got a flag with the seal, and it's just, I think, an incredible moment to have some pride in this institution. In my opinion, one of the greatest brands in the world is the United States FDA, and that's thanks to all of your good work. So it's an exciting time. Now, our mission is very clear, more cures and meaningful treatments for the American public. We want to see lower drug prices and an America First unapologetic agenda when it comes to bringing manufacturing back to the United States. It's a national security issue. And we want healthier food for children. This has been a huge priority in this administration. And so these are very clearly demarcated our primary goals. We've got many more goals. As you know, the FDA regulates 20% of the U.S. economy. It's everything from cosmetics to dog food to mangoes coming across the border to microwave ovens to devices and wearables and, of course, drugs, which is what many people think of when they think of the FDA. So our goal is to achieve this mission is to disrupt the 10 to 12 year timeframe that it takes a new drug to come to market. I learned about GLP-1 drugs when I was in medical school about 30 years ago. Why did it take that long? It's a known peptide that's in the body. And so we need to challenge this assumption that there is something promising, for example, for breast cancer, but we just have to wait 5 or 10 years, even though the results look pretty impressive in early studies. So we need to do this while holding to our mission to safeguard the public. We don't want a public health fiasco because a corner was cut on safety. And so safety has been the number one goal of the FDA, and it will continue to be the number one goal. We want to modernize the agency, and while keeping safety number one, we want to see things move more efficiently. That means faster approvals. And we want to use gold standard science. I've stood by the scientists here at the agency. Every decision on a drug, every approve or reject decision on a drug has been the approve or reject decision of that primary review team. So I've honored that the scientists here, and I think we need to stand by our scientists. And so that's what I plan to do. Now, where are we on drug approvals? We hit a near record last year with 67 approvals of new drugs. That is above the 5, 10, 15, and 20-year average. So we had a banner year for new drug approvals. We also approved drugs in a shorter time frame than in a long time, including hitting some new records. You may have heard, for those of you not directly involved, in the zongertinib approval. That is a powerful medication for a HER2-mutated non-small cell lung cancer, 44 days from filing. That's a record. Tecdara, that was just a couple weeks ago, 55 days from filing. I mean, these drugs are so powerful, they can bring people out of hospice and give them hope again. So when we see these impressive results, in the case of Tecdara, doubling overall survival, 3x the improvement in disease-free progression or death for multiple myeloma. In the case of zongertinib, we went from a standard of care response rate of tumors of 35 to 40% now to 76% reported in the zongertinib trial. So when you see something amazing, we want to act with the same urgency that a patient would want when they see something promising that could help them. So the new priority voucher program has had an average decision time of about 51 days from about five products so far that have gone through this pilot program. Of course, most drugs are not going through this pilot program. This is a pilot program to see if we can do things differently, more efficiently. And so I think the teams here, the scientific teams, which are the groups that nominate the drug products for this new pilot program, they've done a terrific job. They've demonstrated that we can do this. Overall, last year, we had an average approval time that was significantly below our four-year average. That was about 310 days. Again, safety is the number one priority. But if we can reduce idle time, we can deliver some innovation when it comes to regulation. Now, we have a powerful AI tool called ELSA that was homegrown thanks to Jeremy Walsh and the team. And you see, this is an optional tool. As many of you know, it's voluntary. No one is required to use it. But by interacting with this AI tool, asking questions, having it retrieve parts of these gnarly 100,000-plus page applications, the reviewers find tremendous value for this tool. And so what you see is, though, even though it's optional, 90-plus percent of our staff at Cedar, for example, have used it last month, and that we track the number of daily unique users, and it is almost everybody. It is almost everybody. So we're going to continue to innovate in this space. We were the first government agency to have an AI tool agency-wide for our staff. We were the first government agency to have an agentic AI tool for all of the staff agency-wide. And so we're going to continue to have more features, more buttons that are unique to the FDA workflow. So it can, for example, confirm that the formatting is correct for tables or confirm that the application is complete. We have a 60-day filing period. We've been able to get that done in minutes with the AI tool. That's reviewing the completion of the application. Has nothing to do with the scientific review. It's just checking to see if the application is complete. With technology today, it should not take an additional 2 months per drug just to make sure the application is complete. If you're a patient waiting for something that's potentially promising, waiting 2 months to do something has its own risks. That is, patients not being able to have access to something promising. Now, in terms of meeting our user fee target dates, we are at a historic high at 100%. We need 90% of decisions to meet their target dates in order to trigger the PDUFA funding. We were at 92%. We're now at 100%. And so I want to thank everybody who's worked hard to ensure that we meet all of our PDUFA target dates. Again, safety is the number one concern, but a lot of times this is organization. I've told the scientific teams, if you want to convene an advisory committee, think about that early before you get close to the user fee date. We don't want to miss user fee dates because we didn't pre-plan for an advisory committee. Of course, advisory committees take time to set up. So I think they've done a great job doing that. Of course, it is entirely their decision to convene an advisory committee if they find it helpful. But pre-planning is a healthy conversation that I've seen. Now, another major goal is lowering drug prices, and that's through a couple mechanisms. Number one is more generic drugs. And so we're building on one of the successes of Dr. Gottlieb and his tenure when increasing the number of generic drugs was a priority. And so you saw last year, we shot up to 91 new generic drugs. I'd like to see more generic drugs and more generic drugs in the United States. And I hope we can see a GDUFA user fee negotiation that creates the incentives we need to encourage manufacturing in the United States. Now, the other major area of drug spending is something called biologics, a class of drugs. Many of you are very close to this. Many of you are reviewing drugs in this category. The biologics together account for 51% of drug spending, even though they're only about 5% of prescriptions. Now, why are they so expensive? Because they come from cell lines and they cost a lot of money and the development R&D costs may be higher. Well, they shouldn't be unaffordable because then people just don't have access to them. So you can have a cure for a disease that is 100% effective, but only if only half of the population can access that cure, that is, can afford the cure, then that drug has an efficacy now on a population level of 50%. So we have to make sure medications are affordable. The generic versions of these expensive biologics are called biosimilars, and so we have eliminated the comparative efficacy study. That is an entire new clinical trial that was stood up just to show that a generic version of a biologic could be used, okay, that it could go through the process. That was $200, $300 million, depending on the drug. I've heard folks who are in this space tell me that this announcement alone cut their research and development costs in half, say from $500 million to $250 million. I've had people tell me it's going to shave off 2 to 3 years, because if you don't have to go through the comparative effectiveness study, we don't, by the way, require it with small molecules. Why were we doing it with generic versions of biologics? We need to do everything possible to increase affordability of this class of medications. We also did some other reforms. We eliminated the direct PK comparative study. And we also eliminated the routine requirement for a three-way PK comparator study. Each of those studies could be $20 million. So it does add up. When you lower the cost of R&D, it has the promise of translating into lower drug prices for my mom and your mom and everyday Americans that are out there. We also are supporting interchangeability. When the patient and the pharmacist say, hey, we want to use a biosimilar that is much more affordable than the expensive biologic, we want to encourage that. So we put out a statement on that. Now, on the device side, we've also had a banner year with 39 approved last year. Again, this is thanks to the incredible work of everybody in device and radiologic health center, thanks to the good work of Rochelle Tarver and others. So I want to thank that team for their banner year. This speaks to the work on direct-to-consumer advertising, that is pharma ads. This is the number of enforcement letters that have been sent out. This is not our graph. This is a graph from one of the trade publications. The article is titled, A Head-Spinning Year, How U.S. FDA's Ad Enforcement Blitz Reshaped Drug Promotion. Now, I've personally noticed there's fewer ads and the side effects are more explicitly stated. I think we are starting to see better compliance with the two regulations that generally have not been enforced. That is the regulation that ads have to have a fair balance of information for people, and they cannot create a misleading impression. And so in the last year, in my first year, we sent out 72 enforcement letters. By the way, the purple number is the number of specific letters. Black is untitled letters, that is sort of generic letters. So you can see last year the number of enforcement letters directed to a specific entity was zero. We sent out zero. But in our first year here, my first year, we were able to send out 72 enforcement letters and 1,500 letters to the industry notifying them that we very much plan to enforce our regulations. We will crack down on inappropriate direct-to-consumer pharma ads. Our job is to safeguard the public, and if we see things that are misleading, then I'm kindly asking the industry to redirect the enormous spend that they put on these direct ads and redirect that money to lower drug prices for everyday Americans. Now, inspections, we have a big inspectorate, as you know, and surprise inspections overseas are way up. We switched to more surprise inspections last year. We want to see inspections that work. And if an inspection is pre-announced, if it's scheduled, it's a joke. It's an announced inspection is no inspection, in my opinion. And so we are getting away from scheduled inspections, which have been concentrated overseas, and move to surprise inspections. It then makes sense to me that we put American companies on U.S. soil through the ringer with surprise inspections and more inspections, and manufacturing sites overseas have announced inspections and fewer inspections. So we are rebalancing that dynamic. Now, on the food side, we also have had an increase, about a 20% increase in food inspections. And as you know, many of the food inspections are done at the local level. 90% of routine produce inspections, for example, are at a local level. So we are sending money to the states, empowering them to do food inspections that they generally do at a lower cost point, and they're more proximate to the farms. On the tobacco side, we have had a significant reduction in the backlog of these PMTA applications. The applications sort of poured in at a moment where there was discussions of sort of a grandfather grace period. And so the center was overwhelmed with applications. And you, as you can see, we've gone down significantly in the backlog, and we're going to keep going, I think, at this pace or faster this coming year. It's important. On the food side, we had this tremendous response to our call to remove all petroleum-based food dyes, that is the 9 artificial dyes from the U.S. food supply. We had about 40% of the industry, that represents about 60% of the food, say yes. General Mills, I'll just cite them out. There are many companies here that have been absolutely terrific to work with. General Mills just achieved their goal of removing all artificial dyes ahead of schedule. So they just hit this a few weeks ago. We put it out to congratulate them. That's what we want to see. We want to see companies do the right thing. And many times they tell us they just want a level playing field. If they can have a level playing field, they are happy to move in the direction of consumer demand. Now, we also want to have natural food dyes that they can use as an alternative to the artificial dyes. So we had a record number of natural dyes approved last year. We had 6, and we're about to approve 2 more. So for this 12-month period, we're on the brink of 8 approvals for natural dyes to replace the artificial food dyes. Companies want alternatives, and they want alternatives that are cost neutral and feasible to implement. And I think seeing a giant company like General Mills, Nestle, when they come and say, we're ahead of schedule, that tells us this is doable. People said it couldn't be done, it's getting done. Now, the culture of the staff and the workplace satisfaction is very important to me here. There are phenomenal people. I've been impressed by all of you and many of you that I've gotten to know. It's pretty amazing. People come here from all backgrounds. They sometimes make a personal sacrifice. They are giving up sometimes what could be a higher salary outside, but they do it because they believe in the mission and the incredible brand of the FDA. And so Melanie Keller, Dr. Butler, Melissa Shea, the whole team that has done an amazing job to try to create a positive workplace culture, it's working. So if we look at these metrics, that is the staff turnover rate, we are at historic lows when it comes to staff turnover. Now, we don't want to be at zero. We do want people to go on and have a wonderful career, and we believe in their professional development. That was always a mission in academia. People that we loved, we would work with them and have a great experience, but ultimately we do want them to do what's in their own professional development. People move, they get married, there are different things that happen. So we're going to normally have a turnover rate of staff. That's okay. We've got 2,000 plus new scientists coming on board. And it's good to have fresh scientists come on with a new perspective. And so it is healthy to have some turnover, but we are at historic lows when it comes to the staff turnover rate at the FDA now. There was probably some uncertainty early on when there was the restructuring. I'm proud to report now that the culture is strong. The other surrogate marker of workplace satisfaction, in my opinion, and the turnover rate is industry recusals among FDA staff. So how many staff at the FDA have a recusal with industry, which typically they will put into place if they are looking for a job? Well, those recusals demonstrated here in this graph are also way down, significantly down, and they're at significant lows. So thank you. This is your work. My job is to advocate for what people need here, to respond to the needs here, to advocate for the staff here, to make sure the staff have all the resources they need, and to take the good ideas from the staff here, take the good ideas that we hear from those who interface with the FDA, take the new technology that's out there, including AI, and to set the vision and to help foster an adoption of new ideas. But these ideas, many of them are your ideas. Now, we've done a lot to invest in the people here. We are not only hiring 2,000 plus scientists, but we are investing in that community. We are paying people more. We are doing things that are fun. We have family day. We have bring your kid to work day. We have, I think, the Orioles and Nats are playing, and we're going to have FDA night at the stadium. We have farmers markets now twice a week. When the weather's nice, as long as it's not hail and sleet and freezing outside. And so we want to keep going with all these programs. We've extended the hours of our cafeteria service. So when there is a need, please let me know, let the leadership team know, and we want to respond to those needs. We're also doing a lot to consolidate the technology. What we found when I came here, there were a lot of clunky services that were built in isolation. A lot of silos. And so those silos resulted in multiple licensing agreements for software, for the same software. They resulted in systems that didn't communicate between the different centers. And so we've had an amazing team led by Jeremy Walsh to consolidate the application portal. We had 40 different application portals. Now we have one. We had multiple ways to study drugs in the real world. And we had, between the three systems that were very clunky, we now are moving to one system. And the adverse event reporting, which is a staple of the FDA, many people look to our reporting and event rates as an indicator of what's happening with a cosmetic or a product of any sort. And so we took these multiple adverse event reporting databases and really combined them into one system. FAERS, VAERS, CARES, AERS, MAUD. Why do we have so many different adverse event reporting systems? And we did our own analysis. 80% of people, well, 60 to 80%, depending on the system, when they go in to start to report an adverse event, they give up. It's just too long and complicated. And it shouldn't take 45 minutes to report an adverse event. It should have a great user interface. We're going to have that now with one adverse event reporting system. We also save a lot of money with these better systems. And so the total savings we're going to see next year is about $146 million. What are we going to do with that money? We're going to invest it in our community, in our people, and we're going to help be well-resourced to implement the aggressive reform agenda that we've laid out. Here's another indicator. This is the number of visits to our adverse event reporting databases. Okay, the number of times people are going there to either check something or look something up. Now, when we implemented this consolidated database with daily outputs, that is, we used to report adverse events, or you could pull them by quarter, you can now do it on a daily basis. And so when that daily reporting out, or the ability to pull data out on a daily basis was implemented, we saw a ton of visits. And at the same time, at the exact same moment, we saw a massive decline in FOIA requests for the same information. So I know Tiffany loves FOIA requests. Thanks for your good work on that, Tiffany. So what you are seeing here is just a common sense technology solution to get away from the mundane work of just going into our own clunky systems and pulling adverse event rates to then satisfy a FOIA request. Those doing the FOIA requests, which by the way are some hedge funds and others who are trying to figure out whether or not a product is going to have problems in the market or not, and they're, you know, getting this information to plan their investments. I got to give them some credit. Not my thing, but you know, that's what they were doing. Well, they can do that now faster through this daily direct readout. And then digitizing our applications, the paperwork that we have. Up until the 90s, we were still accepting a fair amount of paper applications, 100,000 plus pages for some of these applications. What have we been doing with them? Well, we've had 6 warehouses air-conditioned with staff to just store all this paper. So we're digitizing them. We are moving into the next century or catching up, and we are now digitizing about 8 million pages per week. And the rate is increasing. And what the goal is to close these storage facilities, reassign the staff to other work, and to save money that we can use to invest in our scientific community. So that project is going very well. And by the way, it can be used to train AI. When you have digitized applications, now it can be used for machine learning with the consent of the owner of that information, which is the sponsor. We don't do that without the sponsor's approval, but we are planning to ask companies, would you like this information to be used in an anonymized way for machine learning? And you would also have access to the benefits of that machine learning. So that's an option. It's totally voluntary, but it's something we can only do when we have digitized records. Okay, these are other reforms that we've announced in the last 12 months, going from 2-to-1 clinical trials. It's something that I believe in. It's something that will take a little time to implement. There's guidance that's given out with companies recommending 2 clinical trials. Recently, it's going to be something we have to phase in. We are working on the formal guidance process to change the formal guidance from the agency. We're working on internal training by the statistical team here at the FDA. They are very passionate that you can achieve the same statistical power with a well-designed, well-controlled, appropriately powered single pivotal trial instead of 2 pivotal trials. It's really just a math thing whereby you can achieve the same statistical power. So that is going to be phased in over the next 6 months or so. And we've gotten a tremendous positive response from the industry. One individual told me, we'll be able to run twice as many drugs through a pivotal trial with this new reform. Okay, again, lowering R&D costs, which will translate into lower drug prices for everyday Americans. We want to eliminate all unnecessary animal testing. A lot of it's unnecessary, especially with new technology, especially with common sense. Do you really need 2 species of animal testing when a drug's already approved in widespread use in Europe? No, you don't. So that is part of our roadmap. We also announced you no longer officially need animal testing data for monoclonal antibodies where you have good alternative methodologies. You don't have to test the monoclonal antibody on 144 chimpanzees. You can now submit computational modeling, organ-on-a-chip technology, or whatever else is relevant as a part of our new roadmap to eliminate unnecessary animal testing. And so just recently, we had another major announcement, a milestone on our roadmap, and you're going to see more and more changes here. The guidance draft guidance is now out on these new alternative methodologies. We announced the plausible mechanism framework for ultra-rare diseases. I want to thank Dr. Prasad for his work on this. This was extremely well received, especially in the rare disease community. If there's a plausible mechanism, and it's not feasible to do a randomized controlled trial, we have to use common sense. And we can do that in a way where we are still evaluating safety. And so that is something where we have already had an experience. And we have the success story of baby KJ to show for it. We want to see more baby KJs. That is, baby KJ, for some of you who may not know, had gene editing done as an infant for an ultra-rare disease. That's the kind of thing where we had a great partnership with the doctors involved and a great outcome for the individual. We made our decision letters public. Thanks to Tiffany and others for helping with that. And this, I don't know if the power is running low, but we are, it looks like it's holding here. So we released our decision letters that are what we call the CR or rejection letters. And I think that was widely well-received in industry and among our scientists. Sometimes our scientists take a beating because they can't really say anything about a drug that may not be approved for good reasons. You know, we don't typically engage by disclosing things like safety manufacturing violations. If there's fungus growing in the facility, if there's a major safety issue with the plant, if there is a clinical trial that completely failed in its primary and secondary endpoints, and people are wondering, hey, why is this medication not approved? Now all of that information is disclosed in these public CR letters. If we don't accept a medication in whatever round that it's submitted, the public deserves to know why. It creates some accountability for us at the FDA. It also helps drug developers understand how the review teams think, what they look for, what are the common reasons why medications may not be accepted. Again, we're at near record high levels of approvals, but if we do not approve a medication, the public deserves to know why. We want to see more approvals. At the same time, we need to follow the law, which says very clearly that there has to be quote unquote substantial evidence to support safety and efficacy. So we are, I think, doing an impressive job, and this is part of our broad transparency agenda. 70H is an opioid that's showing up on streets in America. People have not called it an opioid. They don't even know what it is. We really were the first to go very public to say, this is an opioid. 70H and its derivatives, they go by many names. These are synthetic concentrated forms of 70H, which is also found in the kratom leaf. We are not focused on the kratom leaf or kratom plant. We are focused on the synthetic 70H that is made in laboratories at high concentrated levels that is killing Americans. And it may not show up in the autopsy reports. It may just be chalked up to fentanyl. But this is a new synthetic opioid, and we, for the first, I think, time in history, have called it an opioid. It binds to the mu receptor. By definition, it's an opioid. And we've been working with DEA to get it scheduled as a controlled substance. It's been off the map, but we are raising awareness around 70H because we don't want more kids to die from it. So some of the really good work. I want to just quickly mention some of the additional reforms that we have implemented in the last 12 months. We removed the black box warnings on hormone replacement therapy to tell women the truth about the short-term and profound long-term public health benefits of hormone replacement therapy. Demand for hormone replacement therapy has surged since our announcement. We had over 25 million visits and views across our different social media platforms on this public event and announcement. We want women to know the truth. 50 million women have been denied hormone therapy or never offered it or talked out of it over the previous 22 years because of the fear machine scaring women away from it. And the FDA is guilty. They piled on at that time about 22, 23 years ago by putting these black box warnings. We are now using science and not dogma to base those warnings. So huge, tremendous positive feedback. We also have new guidance on wearables and devices that use AI to have clear lanes for what's regulated and what's not regulated. We have a pre-check program for domestic manufacturing to encourage new manufacturing in the United States. We are also announcing incentives to move particular manufacturing lines from overseas to the United States. And we are, as you saw, released a new food pyramid. So people said, you guys do that? And I said, yes, remember, this is the Food and Drug Administration. And so we worked very closely with USDA. Secretary Rollins has been a great partner and her team. And so I'm very proud of the new food pyramid that we were able to put out, which is essentially a procurement document for school lunch programs and the military. So now they can use taxpayer dollars for food that we can agree, based on the best nutrition science, is real food, not just food-like substances or whatever else we've been buying. We are modernizing infant formula, changing the monographs, and we are allowing real-world evidence to be admitted into applications. We've announced this intent. Real-world evidence is not necessarily great evidence, but it is evidence, and companies should be at least allowed to submit it as part of their applications, instead of the onerous requirements that we've had, limiting what type of evidence you're allowed to submit. Now, the biggest threat that we have in the drug space is China. China surpassed us around 2021, where more clinical trials were being done in China. And if you look at the initiation of a phase one trial, there are about four times more in China than the United States the year before I came to the FDA. This is a significant issue, and we can't ignore it. So we have a problem that we have to acknowledge and we have to address by reevaluating what we are doing that makes us non-competitive. And so that means we look at everything. Everything needs to be on the table. So if you look at the entire drug approval process, we have examined this process, sent teams to Australia, which is a country now taking phase one trials in lieu of United States phase one sites, and asked, what can we do differently to modernize and streamline the process, to increase the user interface, to partner with industry, to have the FDA as a regulator work with them along the process to increase communication, to use AI and whatever else we need to do to make this process more efficient. We're doing it, number one, for patients towards our broader mission of more cures and meaningful treatments for the American public. And number two, to be more competitive internationally. So we are looking at each of these phases. Now, these are broadly the reforms that we are exploring with each of these. Some have been announced, some have been successful, and some are in the planning and exploration phases. So in the pre-IND process, right now it's 380 days between the average pre-IND request from a sponsor to meet with the FDA until the IND itself. It's 380 days, this section right here. Well, in China, it's about 220 days, and they just announced they're going to go to 60. Can we partner with universities and CROs and others who can coach sponsors through this process? Can we do a pilot in that space? We have a team working on that. Can we reduce the requirements of the IND? They really have not been updated in decades. And I was just going through them with Grace Graham, our deputy commissioner, and some of those requirements are just outdated. We have to be efficient. We should not be requiring things that are not central to safety or efficacy. So we are changing the requirements on the IND itself. On the phase one trials, many of those are delayed by hospital contracting and because IRBs are not turning around approvals quickly. Some institutions do not recognize central IRBs. They use their own in-house IRBs. They take about 2.5 times longer. And if you know anything about these IRB committees, they often meet monthly with a group of volunteers from the hospital. Well, I remember it took a year and a half when I was at Johns Hopkins to get a study through the IRB. If you think about it, the entire U.S. research infrastructure is dependent on this rate-limiting step that is log-jamming researchers and making us non-competitive with IRBs overseas. So we can run ethical IRBs in the United States by having a different process. Maybe it's paying members of the IRB. Maybe telling the universities it's a part of accreditation. Maybe it's telling the universities that you have to use a central IRB or get the IRBs turned around with a decision within, say, 30 or 60 days. I don't know what the right solution is, but we are smart people in the United States. We can fix this logjam. We are losing business. We are seeing trials go overseas. These are drugs that are ultimately used in U.S. patients. And so we're looking at IRB reform and master contracting to help speed this up. We also are going to be launching real-time continuous clinical trials. That is, clinical trials whereby FDA regulators get the data directly from the electronic health record, of course, with the consent of the individual, so they can see safety signals and efficacy signals and even use Bayesian analyses so that we can stop a trial when we clearly see something's working or we clearly see a safety signal and allow trials to be run phase one, phase two, and phase three continuously towards the broader goal of regulators looking at endpoints in the cloud. Now, again, this would be a pilot program, but we are very close to announcing a real-time continuous trial whereby sponsors can allow regulators to see the data as it is happening in real time. We are embracing Bayesian statistics that helps with optimal dosing of medications. We talked about going from 2-to-1 pivotal trials. That all really helps in the phase three clinical trial. And then we're going to narrow this filing period from 2 months to a couple days. We don't need a 2-month period just to see if your application's complete. So we're going to see this filing period come down. The review of the NDA or BLA takes about a year. We've seen now that we can successfully get decisions out in as short as 44 days. And so we need to make sure we're well-resourced if we're going to be doing more priority reviews. But that time period of about 50 days is far faster than the traditional priority reviews of, say, 6 months or 8 months. And so, again, speed is not the number one priority. Safety is. But if our review teams can cut the idle time, then let's take advantage of that concept. We're also allowing the manufacturing CMC portion of the application to be reviewed before the clinical trial reads out. If you remember, in certain applications, say, for example, in the past, everyone's waiting for the clinical trial to read out. And then once it reads out, we get a giant application. Well, we can review most of that before the clinical trial reads out. So if we can get the lion's share in the door, and this is an offer to industry, it's not a requirement, if they want to get the CMC portion in or have inspectors go to the facility in our new sort of expanded pre-check program, then that can help save time as well. And then there's the post-market after an approval where we look at the performance of drugs. We can do much better on that. We shouldn't be learning 5 years after Vioxx was approved that it may have killed 38,000 Americans, or we shouldn't be learning that OxyContin may have killed 500,000 plus Americans 15 years or 20 years later. We should have eyes on a drug immediately after it's approved. We can do this now with big data. This fits our broader tech big data platform agenda, and we can have eyes on every single drug that's approved, not just do an expedition looking at a single drug or device. So that's a broader view of where we are going with this process. Now, I'm going to lay out a couple specific goals. Of course, we have dozens of goals, but here's a couple simple ones. We want to reform the IND and phase one process. And this is a focused effort. We want to see more drugs over the counter. Why do you need to sit in an urgent care facility when you know you need a certain medication, or your doctor has told you, but you don't have a way to get the prescription, or you have nausea and you know that nausea medication helps? Do you really need to go to wait in an emergency room and get worked up with the kitchen sink of tests only to get a medication that you know you may need? So by moving medications to over-the-counter, we think we can lower healthcare utilization, save people money, and also there's something magical about a medication being on the shelf because it has a price. So people don't have to experience the money games, the shell game behind the pharmacy counter of the pharmacy benefit managers. And so price transparency does keep prices in check for consumers broadly. And it also enables competition of different products. So there's a lot of benefits to over-the-counter drugs. I'd like to see vaginal estrogen and several other medications go to over-the-counter this year. We'd like to see inspections of manufacturing plants go to one day as a screening inspection. We don't need to be there for 2 or 3 weeks routinely. We can do a one-day safety review, look for major flags, and if the inspector sees something that is concerning, they have the right to expand the inspection to take longer. But we can get through a one-day inspection checklist to do more inspections, surprise inspections, and have a better yield. We're also using AI to hone in on high-yield targets for inspections. If a facility has had a perfect track record for 50 years, that is a low-yield place to inspect. If another place has many indicators that it may warrant a close review, that's where the AI helps us hone in. We're using it for food inspections. It's worked very well. And we're going to be doing the same for manufacturing of drug inspections. Real-time continuous clinical trials, we talked about that. And beyond this year, I would like to see as a broader goal a cure or powerful treatment for type 1 diabetes. We are talking to the scientists and learning about what's early in the pipeline. It's one of the best parts of this job, and to hear what's out there. If there's something that looks promising in early studies, we want to be very involved and watch that technology and usher it through if it ends up being promising. And so not just type 1 diabetes, but I'd like to see a powerful treatment for ALS. I believe we can get there in the next couple years. Not just to slow down neurodegenerative conditions, but to halt them or reverse the progression altogether. I'd like to see some of these powerful cancer drugs getting through the system so that people can experience the benefits. Metastatic cancer, certain types of microsatellite instability, GI cancers. We're now seeing PD-1 inhibitors result in a complete elimination of the cancer. Surgeons are seeing these tumors disappear over the course of treatment. They no longer need surgery, chemo, or radiation in the case of some rectal cancers. That's amazing. That's amazing on many levels. Not only is it a miracle for those suffering, it reduces downstream healthcare utilization and all of the morbidity and disability that comes with some of these operations I used to do. So this is exciting. We want to see more cancer cures and more cures across many of the conditions here, be it pediatric kidney disease, be it autoimmune diseases. We're on the brink of some major scientific discovery. We should be ushering in those potentially promising treatments. I think we can get to a universal flu shot, so you don't need to every year come in and get your flu shot. We're not very good as a medical community in guessing which strain is going to be dominant because the polymerase on influenza is very flimsy, and so it mutates at a much higher rate than other viruses. So we're just, it's just not a good system. And flu takes tens of thousands of lives typically each year. I think we can see a universal flu shot with long-term protection that will even protect against strains that have not yet mutated in nature. And finally, I think we're going to see some powerful treatments in the space of aging. Now, some of you may not want certain individuals to live long, but they may have the opportunity to do so. So in summary, and thank you again, Dr. Butler, for this amazing seal. I'm going to show it off at every opportunity. The FDA is doing very well. We are strong as an agency. We're going to continue to be strong. We're operationally strong. We are going to use evidence and science as the core foundation of our decisions here, not politics. And we are going to aggressively modernize the agency with AI and other technology, ultimately with the broader goal of delivering more cures and meaningful treatments and healthier food for children in a great workplace environment for the staff here. So I want to take a moment and just thank all of you for the incredible work that you've done. I want to mention some of you by name, but it'll be at the risk of not getting everybody I should. But thank you for all your great work. It's been a great year. We've had some challenges early on, but it's been a great year. We've performed well, and we're going to have a great next year. So thank you.